feel like I'm sitting in the classroom with my former teachers in the audience. We want to speak this morning, first on the subject of poverty and the affluent society, and then on the apostolate of the poor in spirit. You might know at the beginning that there is more than psychological value in spelling out the implications of what we do. For example, it's more effective to realize that I'm reading, say, Milton, or Shakespeare, or one of the saints, than just to think that I'm reading. Or, more important, to realize what I am thinking than just that I am thinking. So with the various life, one of the secrets of achievement is to break it down to its specifics and to ask ourselves, what does it mean to live the religious life? For us it means to live in poverty, to live in chastity, to live obedience. In other words, the vocation to which Christ has called us is not made to some kind of generic, amorphous following of him, but a vocation to poverty, a vocation to chastity, and a vocation to obedience. As more than semantics, first then we ask ourselves, what is this vocation to poverty to which Christ has called us? If Christ was the first religious, he must have had the first vocation to a life of evangelical poverty. Remember, always as man, he was both sent and in a true sense called by his heavenly body. As we read the pages of the Gospels, we find that the poverty of Christ, which is the model of Rome, is at the same time the best definition of poverty. When we speak of being called to live in his life, what we mean is being called to follow the first great religious, Jesus himself. And after all, the theology has been exhausted in order to define things, no matter what they are, whether it's grace or the virtues, or your poverty, we see how Christ practiced what we want to define. His practice is the best definition. The practice of poverty by Christ is featured by two elements, which we might call the foci of evangelical poverty. They were first dependence. Dependence on other human beings for his material needs. And second, by sharing what he had with others. Those two pretty well cover. And of course, it takes a lifetime to live them out. Dependence for material needs and sharing what you got. When these two are practiced as faithfully as possible in imitation of Christ, we have the foundations for the religious life. And this is not a platitude. Because when Christ called the rich young man to himself, if you want to be perfect, go sell what you have, give to the poor, and then come follow me, he was the needed substratum for the perfect following of himself. It is therefore not only euphemistic, it's not only euphonic to have a sequence read poverty, chastity, and obedience. There is a divine foundation for that. The beginnings of the perfect following of Christ are laid on poverty. Poverty doesn't merely come first, it is first. When Christ told the rich young man to go sell what you have and then come follow me, The implication was, as a conjunction that he put into that sentence, and come follow me, was conditioned on first going and selling. We saw earlier, when we examined the love just in a broad perspective, that each of the counsels, by definition, goes beyond the precept. Your poverty, as we understand it, goes beyond the law or the precept. The law in the Decalogue says, thou shalt not steal. The counsel says, will you please give? Where the divine mandate commands that we do not appropriate, we don't take away. The counsel wants us to expropriate what we have. Where the command requires that we be satisfied with what we have, and not enrich ourselves at another person's expense. The counsel requests that we enrich the neighbor by impoverishing ourselves. Let's be sure we don't miss that. Let's be sure that poverty doesn't mean throwing to the winds. Poverty is always a relationship between me, who become poor, and someone else, whom I enrich. Christ did not say, take what you've got and dump it in the Lake of Galilee. In plain language, then, the vocation to poverty is a call to give what we possess of everything that has material value. And we know that the longer we live in religion, the longer we realize that it is not merely a once for all giving away. We've got to keep giving away. And the hardest part of that giving away is not the physical separation of something from me. It's the psychological disenchantment which I've got to work at. For I keep expropriating what I have, mainly in spirit, and only quite secondarily in body. We need to talk about this poverty first negatively and then positively. Negatively, it means to be free from the encumbrances of this world so as to more easily seek the things of God. I empty myself of things that are pleasing to me in the material order so that I might more effectively and efficiently serve the Lord. But positively, my poverty is, and really, it's poverty and not mere impoverishment. When by it I offer to God in sacrifice, and it is meant to be that, as a symbol of self-giving. You see, the three dedications that encompass the spiritual life are really three forms of sacrifice, where by definition, all sacrifice is the surrender of something desirable to God. That's it. It's got to be something desirable, otherwise I don't sacrifice it. And it must be surrendered, otherwise clearly it's not a sacrifice. And it must be to God, otherwise it may be a loss, or somebody may have stolen it. It's not a sacrifice. And then the first of the great sacrifices that we make is the sacrifice of those things which go by the generic and most expressive name of ownership. These things are not me. We'll talk about the we part in the other two dedications. This is not exactly we. This is what belongs to us. This is ours. This is the apostrophe side of our life, corresponding to the gender case. Let's note, however, that poverty does not mean destitution. Even for the Franciscans, even for Francis of Assisi, though in one dramatic gesture he stripped himself, you know the story. We, after all, he did put a cloak on. And Franciscans, over the centuries, have not been destitute. The measure then of our perfectly we practice poverty, we individually or collectively as a community, is not how little we have. There are a lot of poor people who are not poor in spirit. And there are wealthy people who are poor in spirit. It should be measured for us, as beings, by how effectively our dependence on the community and sharing with its members and with the world outside fosters the purpose for which the community was founded. To extend the kingdom of God in the hearts of men. Just to repeat it in a brief sentence. Our poverty is not destitution. We are not, therefore, for that reason, more perfectly practicing poverty, the less we have. But rather, whatever we have is most effective in advancing that for which we enter the religious life, which is our own sanctification and the sanctification of others. Now we come to the backdrop of what we want to fit into place against these short lineaments of what evangelical poverty is, and that is American wealth. If there is an argumento which is called upon, especially the American religious, of which even the saintly Pope John had only the vaguest idea, he not only ever had, shall we call it, the privilege of visiting the United States, the update which the Church of God required, especially for its religious, particularly concerns those religions in those countries that are enveloped as with an atmosphere, with affluence that the world has never known. Therefore, any estimate of evangelical poverty, any practicalizing for the future, of how this poverty of ours is supposed to be practiced, which does not take stock, serious stock, of the kind of people that enter religious communities in the United States, by and large, the kind of a world in which these religions live, and the kind of a world for whom they work, is to be lost in the clouds, is to have one's feet straight up in the air. I think our nearest competitor, he is less than 30% in enjoying our prosperity. My comparison to Japan, which is in many ways a highly industrialized nation, we are per capita 10 times as prosperous as Japan. But more than that, we are the wealthiest nation in human history. We are the most prosperous in per capita earnings. We are the nation in which men and women live the longest lives. The nation where they experience the least sickness and physical pain. the nation where they eat the most food, drink the most drink. The only nation that had, what shall we call it, the arrogance or the concern to feel constrained to build into the sacred constitution of its laws an amendment to restrain the use of alcoholic beverages. We are the nation in which people have to work the least and exert themselves to the absolute minimum. We are the nation in which the most money is spent for entertainment, cosmetics, outside of religious communities, smoking, and even for, say, caring for lawns. I just went to the trouble of finding out how much money is spent per year for the care of lawns. 1.5 billion in the United States. More, the statistic said, than the whole defense budget of the English Empire. I checked this morning the circulation of some national magazines, and I found to my surprise that two of the largest circulating magazines are Better Homes and Gardens, with a monthly circulation of 6.5 million, and Good Housekeeping, with a circulation of 5.5 million every month. American affluence has changed the face of the earth in which we live to a point that is simply incomprehensible to most Americans. It's like a fish not knowing what it is to be out of water. What this affluence has done is to have made the enjoyment of pleasure so easy and almost so indispensable that by comparison the ancient Romans and Greeks were models of asceticism. It has made physical pain the one thing most to be dreaded, and if possible, would be eliminated altogether. America, then, is first of all hedonistic. It is, to coin a word, anesthetic. It has also made the United States a country in which physical exertion, just sheer manual labor, for millions, minimal, and for other millions, marginal. From 60 hour week to 50 to 40 to 30, to as little as possible. America is an indolent nation. It has finally made the United States a place where personal choice and initiative are becoming more and more unnecessary, with everything organized and automatized and federalized, to the point where the individual is becoming a cog in the machinery of a nation whose only concern seems to be to get all the joys out of this life, because that's all there is. Is it any wonder that over 70 million Americans never once a year step inside of a church or synagogue? 70 million. In Kalamazoo, where I teach, a lot of churches seem to be speckled with church spires. Yet, the official statistic from Kalamazoo, from the National Council of Churches, gives 27% of Kalamazooans go to church on Sunday. 73% sleep or play golf. What is the impact of this affluence on Vietnam's life? The impact, first of all, is there. And if we're just convinced of that, we've learned a lot. And one of the limitations to which religious are subject, unless they go out of their way or are, you might say, put into the path of being in contact with this will and affluence and its consequences, is that so many believers are unaware of what's swirling all around them, be correspondingly unaware of how deeply this has infected, at least affected, their own thinking. Hedonism is in the air we breathe. And consequently, extraordinary care must be exercised by believers not to seek pleasure for its own sake. We're not Jansenists. We know that pleasure in itself is good. But it is always and is so intended by God to be only a means to an end. It is only something which God allows us to experience, not always, but betimes, in order to, you might say, lubricate the wheels of human existence, to keep them from grinding to a halt for sheer lack of energy to keep going. We've got to learn, consequently, the correlative experience and satisfaction which comes from joy as distinct from pleasure. And if ever we think that's an etymological distinction for the lexicographers, we have not really begun to live the religious life. To be willing to sacrifice pleasure for joy, to give up things which we call satisfactions, emotional satisfaction of desire that we have, especially in our bodies and feelings, for that profound joy of spirit which Christ promises to those who love him. Man can be defined as an animal seeking happiness. And it all depends on where we find that happiness. And we've got to find it in religious life, or we quit. Nobody can keep going and live even a normally good life, let alone a life of the consuls, without, mark my words, enjoying himself. We have got to be happy. And happiness is not reserved for that eschatological experience which we call heaven. It is there indeed. Heaven is perfect happiness. But either we have a foretaste system, either we have a foretaste of heaven in this life in serving God, or we shall never get to heaven. So it is not a question of being crushed by sorrow, cringing under the weight of these counsels. It is not as though we work out our salvation gritting our teeth, clenching our fists, fighting every inch of the way. This is something which the spirit of man is to enjoy, even in the midst of poverty, because, properly understood and devoutly practiced, for the hedonism which wealth, material wealth promises, we have our own kind of, shall we call it, hedonism. is a form of beatitude that God himself has promised. It ate long and what looked like painful offerings to God to serve. Let's once in a while look up the dictionary to see what beatitude means. Beatitude means happiness. Blessed, we're stuck with the Anglo-Saxon. What it means is happy are the poor in spirit. Then, were the world wed as it is to material things, consider it almost as an absolute evil to be avoided at all costs. Where I am almost coming to think that the definition of sin, the definition of sin in the world's terms is physical evil. You know our definition, moral evil. That which hurts is bad. What's bad? Only that which hurts. What's good? That which doesn't hurt. The care that we have got to exercise to make sure we don't, I don't say spend our lives running away from pain, but at least avoiding pain more often than we should, and forgetting that pain is highly profitable, that Christ our Lord took him back, the first great images. He chose pain. Pain as a means of sanctification of the world. We were redeemed through pain. And we're going to co-redeem with Christ only through pain. Christianity minus the cross is paganism. Ancestors, unless my poverty hurts, I'm not practicing it. Many. I may read books enough. I may teach it. I may be able to give a whole semester's course on poverty, but I'm not practicing it. Then the effort, which a world sunk in its affluence hates to exert. And while automation certainly is a wonderful thing as a gift of God and has great prospective future, I cannot help think, knowing the number of people who are in the field of automation, who tell me the driving force behind automation is affluence. People just don't want to exert themselves. And they plumb the secrets of nature to find out what new button can I push to keep from taking another step. I hear kind of praying on thin ice. But I deal a lot with professionals in the field of teaching. And I know many days. I have often made this invidious comparison, which I pass on to you, at least as a passing thought. I do not think the average business works as hard as the average professional in the same field. Finally, institutionalism, which of course is part of the affluent society, because we learn that things are more successful when they're organized, they're more efficient. Supermarkets make more money and can hand out food more easily than individual neighborhood stores. Now, institutionalism is not bad. Clearly not. The church is an institution. But anyone who thinks that we can, and anyone who thinks we can do it in modern times without institutions, so he does not know man's social nature and the development of society. But efficiency and organization which are so prevalent in the world today, may not become what in some places they are becoming, a tyrant in the religious life. A certain temple, I work these words out carefully, a certain temple of relaxed activity should pervade the lives of those who set least value on size, speed, and quantity, and most value on things of the spirit, where spirit, by definition, has no size, no speed, occupies no space. God, we should never forget, weighs nothing. Now we come to what for me is the most interesting side of this business of living out the life of evangelical harmony in a world that has gone mad with affluence. There are many things we're going to talk about in the course of these conferences which I hope will help us to live out this harmony. Remembering always that poverty is not just a framework for our inner life. It isn't just stated first before cast in obedience. Our religious life, individually and collectively, is just as strong as our heart. This is the weakest chain in the link that binds us to God. And over the centuries, when religious life has fallen on bad times, as it did in the 16th century, the main reason there was a Protestant revolution, why millions were lost to Christianity, why whole monasteries and convents were gutted of their members, was because those monasteries and convents had forgotten their evangelical poverty. Sisters, I say this with all my heart. I am deeply concerned for the religious life in modern times unless we take a strong, hard look at our practice of poverty and with God's grace, do something about it. Without that re-examination and assessment, the Vatican Council will have been convened largely in vain. How then to live out this poverty? The simplest in the sense of most easily expressed, but hardest because it takes a lifetime to do it, is to live our community life with all of its implications as perfectly as possible. If I live out this life of sharing, notice, only one half the essence of poverty is that I give up. The other side is that I share. And as we know, the two are so closely intertwined and correlative that for all practical purposes, my getting up means sharing. And in order to share, I have to give up. You see, things which are material and poverty deals with such, otherwise than with things of the spirit, are divisible. In fact, that's our philosophical definition of matter. That which can be divided. It means then that the moment I share, I release, I give up as much as I share. Why should community life of all things be so effective in practicing the evangelical poverty to which we have dedicated ourselves? And which we hope to practice in spite of, mind you, in spite of, the atmosphere of wealth all around us. reason is because the demands they make on self-sacrifice are paralytic. They start from the moment they get up in the morning, and they go on till the next morning when they get up. They go on to the day and the night. We come, as the postulants soon find out, from divergent backgrounds, some from this side of the tracks, some from the other side, some from South Newfoundland and Shaker Heights, some from West 7th and West 6th Street in Cleveland, you see, I know Cleveland. And these backgrounds are not only a matter of wealth, but of enjoyment, of the things that people have been accustomed to. We come from such a divergence, kaleidoscopic variety of tastes. It's not only that. Some people, for example, like more salt or more sugar and others less. Some people just don't like certain things, and they tell you. And their first meal in the postulancy is a thing they've been avoiding for 15 or 18 rational years. We either come from different age backgrounds, or pretty soon we discover there are big differences in age. Now, while there are families where there are, say, grandchildren and great even grandmothers and fathers, by and large, the age span or spectrum within a normal domestic family is rather small. The longevity statistics are almost tested to the breaking point in the limits, both lowest and highest, in various communities. Then the temperaments. Aristotle found four. We discover as many as there are on the mission or in the community. Aristotle was never a religious. We come with such a variety of needs. There are some that want to be left alone. Others that can never be alone. There are some that like cold, somber colors. Others that just crush, they want to scream. That black, that blue. A former student of mine in high school visited me in Louisville some years ago. And as we got talking, I asked him what his job was. He told me he was a psychologist, mind you. A psychologist for a large department store in Louisville. I said, what do you do? He said, I psychologize. My job, he says, is to visit people who want to buy furnishings, talk things over with them, and according to their respective tastes and temperaments, we furnish their homes. I said, you're kidding. Oh. People with certain temperaments, and of course, he makes sense. You got a degree in the subject. Of adapting color lines to certain personalities. Can you imagine, I'd like to tell my sisters, can you imagine if your first mission being met by the superior and being asked, sister, how would you like to have your room decorated? The living out of community life, not only begrudgingly or sharing in the sense that, all right, I get one fifth of the cake, which was cut into five pieces. But a sharing, which goes down deep into the spirit, because I do not truly share if I just quantitatively measure out so much for you and so much for me. It is that every time it occurs, and sisters, mark my words, if you're just conscious of it, this thing is going to occur a dozen or several dozen times a day. Fortunately, we're not always conscious of it. It could become oppressive. The degree to which, in our community life, from the closed window when we're suffocating, to the open window when we're breathing, which somebody else closed or opened, all of those details, which with God's grace we gradually come to take for granted, and even enjoy, that's supposed to be our enjoyment. Because, let's keep always in mind the second part of that essence of poverty, that somehow I give up something of what is mine. If I had my own home, I close the window when I want to, and I keep it wide open when I want to, and I put the dressing on the salad as thick as possible, and I have a whole shelf of spices in the kitchen. But being a realist, every time I sacrifice not merely what I had, but what I could have had and would have had, I am living out this poverty where one only should be lived out in spirit, which means inside. That's what this poverty in spirit means. It means poverty inside, where the spirit is. It means that with God's grace, I actually prefer. Of course, this takes time for the young postulants and novices. Take my word for it. Gradually, you'll get there. You'll come to enjoy these things. To be satisfied with less rather than more. For the first 2 or 3 years in the community, you will see how big a piece she cut off. Afterwards, you won't care. Or if you do, you will watch your eyes. You will come, now this is unusual, to be satisfied sometimes with more rather than less. That's a new one. Because you will realize there are members of the community who are accustomed to more. And for this and their sake, you won't complain, well, I thought we and in a poor community. Look at all this food. Look at all this waste. Well, I hope food is not wasted. The point is, there are certain delicacies, certain things which perhaps I could as well do without. But notice, the very divergence of temperaments, the very fact that some girl came from the heights, and I came from the slums, means that for her living in this life is occasionally at least to get a little taste of the Heights atmosphere. It means that I am satisfied if I am living this poverty in spirit with the kind of clothing I get. I would never have known this, how could I? Until a sister of a large community who has charge of the shoes for that community told me. She could write a book about sister shoes. She's a very shrewd and very sharp observer. She had thought that I may think that many sisters compensate for what they cannot get out of things for demanding just this shoe of this type of this size. I didn't realize some 2, 3, 4 times they will send the sheep back infrequent. Satisfied with a kind of clothing, the place of residence. And then I suggest that your community at all in its names ought to quite deliberately have at least some issues that are notoriously poor. I don't say they shouldn't have running water. It's almost a necessity these days. At least that our places of residence should not be superior to the people for whom we work. A good simple norm of community poverty, and therefore my living along with that community life, is how rich are the people for whom we work? And as far as possible, to make sure that poverty is what they practice and the wealth does not irritate. For us as believers who profess poverty, it is absolutely essential that we not only practice poverty really, but in this what St. Ignatius was especially concerned about with his sons, be sure that you give the evidence of practicing poverty. What he called the species paupertatis, the external appearance of poverty. So that while for us individually, living out the community life is if not the easiest, the surest way and safest of practicing this poverty which we have dedicated ourselves to, the community as a whole should be insured against not only wealth or affluence within the community, but that also the external appearances of poverty will be such that those for whom we work will always see in us dedicated followers of a very poor Jesus Christ, who said on his own terms, he did not have whereon to lay his head. I think we reconvene in, is it 20 minutes?